You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research out of UW-Madison looks at how our gut bacteria turns different systems in our bodies on and off and what a typical Western diet does to it.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families is proposing changes to how the state handles child support. The proposal would lower how much wealthy parents have to pay.
The idea is similar to legislation Republican State Representative Joel Clayfish introduced in 2013 that had been co-written by a wealthy divorced campaign donor. The bill was controversial at the time and ultimately unsuccessful. The Wisconsin State Journal just received a copy of a 2015 report from the Child Support Guidelines Advisory Committee. That report recommended no changes to current child support and child custody rules.
Molly Beck joins us to talk about this proposal and what kind of reaction it's getting so far. She's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how would this proposed change affect the way wealthy parents in Wisconsin would pay for child support?
Sure. This proposal is different than the one that was proposed in Representative Clayfish's bill from 2013, in that for parents who earn between $300,000 and $500,000 annually, it would put them on a sliding scale to reduce the percentage of their income, their higher income, that would be paid in child support. What Representative Clayfish's bill would have done would have banned judges from using any income above $150,000 to apply that percentage that would be paid in child support. So it's a little bit different, but it does ultimately reduce the amount of child support that wealthier parents pay.
And are there other aspects of the proposal aside from the sliding scale fee?
This is part of a slate of changes that the department is proposing. They're also looking at proposing a different way for judges to determine what level child support parents who are unemployed should be expected to pay. And those changes would include considering, you know, the person's environment and what jobs are available in their environment, things like that. So there's a number of changes that they're proposing. This is just one of them.
What do we know about where the idea for these changes came from this time around?
So the department convened a committee in 2015, and there were lawmakers on it and child support agency representatives and advocates and judges, and I believe a representative from the State Bar Association. They got together and they looked at what changes could be made to how the state handles child support and child placement and custody situations. And from that work, the department has put forward these changes to how they administer the state's child support program. The committee strongly recommended not to change how the state calculated what wealthier parents pay in child support. But they said, if you're going to do it, if you want to do it, then here's how we think you should do it. And that's where the sliding scale came from.
Why did the committee say that their strongest inclination was not to change the formula?
The report says that there's not any data that demonstrates a specific income level at which, you know, the amount of money that is being paid goes beyond what could reasonably be determined to be child support. You know, proponents of making changes to this say that it's, you know, more fair for the wealthier parent who's paying if they know that the money that they're paying is going to the child and not to either their ex-spouse or the other parent of the child to, you know, for things in their life instead of just care for the children.
Now, it sounds as though this proposal could closely follow in the footsteps of an earlier failed law from Representative Joel Clayfish that we've talked about. Are they connected in any way other than they're both tackling this same aspect of child support?
As far as I know, that's, you know, what I've seen is it's just tackling the same issue. But, you know, the people that I've talked to who are on that committee, that's the first thing they bring up, that this is something that kind of gets at the same goal of reducing the percentage of child support that wealthy parents pay. And the people that I've talked to have expressed concern about that. And there was a public hearing on these changes today, and it wasn't very well attended. There was only, I believe, three people that testified, and two of them did express concern for this particular proposal.
Molly Beck is with us right now. She's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she's with us to talk about a new proposal to lower how much wealthy parents have to pay in child support. And Molly, you said there was a hearing, only a few people testifying. Does that indicate that there's not a lot of energy around this bill on at least some sides?
I don't know if that's true or not. I know that it wasn't posted on the department's website. I couldn't find it noticed anywhere. Somebody sent me a link to the proposals and let me know that there was going to be a hearing. So I'm not sure that the public really, the public at large knew about it. But they said that they wanted to get this going before the legislature comes back in January, and that's why they scheduled it right before Christmas.
And what did the people who spoke have to say about it?
One person, he is the child support services director for Milwaukee County, Jim Sullivan. He said that he was pretty happy with most of the changes they were proposing, but this high payer proposal was concerning to him. He said that Milwaukee County takes care of maybe 1/3 of the child support cases in the state, and he hasn't heard of anybody asking for this. And another person who testified was Senator-elect LaTonya Johnson of Milwaukee, who had similar concerns.
Can you talk, Molly, a little bit about how child support is intended to be used and how it's calculated currently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right now, there's different tiers of percentages depending on the income level. So if you have one child, the current law allows courts to require 17% of your income of $84,000 or less to be paid for that child to the other parent who takes care of the child the majority of the time. That percentage increases, obviously, with, more children, maxing out at 34% for five or more children. And then if on the high end, if the parent's income exceeds $150,000 annually, 10% of the remaining income would be paid in child support for one child and 20% for five or more children. And that would this proposal would reduce the percentage that wealthier parents on the high end pay.
Do we have any idea how many people in Wisconsin, how many parents this could affect if it changes?
That's a great question, one that I'm trying to answer today. It doesn't sound like it's very many. I think it's single percentage, numbers, so I'm not sure that it's a lot.
And Molly, what happens next?
So what happens next is the department secretary will send what she believes should go to Governor Walker's desk. So and then he will either approve or not approve the proposed changes. And if he approves them, they will go to standing committees in the legislature for approval.
Molly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Molly Beck, state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about a new proposal to lower how much wealthy parents have to pay in child support. In just the past few years, we've been hearing a lot about the microbes that live in our guts and how important they can be to our health.
Turns out that we are important to their health, too. And while we may think of what we eat as fuel for our bodies as a whole, we might want to think about what we're feeding those colonies of bacteria, too.
Kim Krautkramer is part of a team that's looking at what effect different diets have on those microbes living inside us. She's an MD, PhD student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with those microbes that are living in our gut. Give us the 101. What are they?
Sure. So I think it's become really clear over the last maybe decade or so that we sort of have almost like a second or another metabolic organ that lives in our gut. And it's actually composed of bacteria, viruses, and fungi. And these sort of bugs provide us as a host with a whole new repertoire of sort of machinery to break down some of the contents in our food that we use for energy, to the extent that, so they have more than 550 times the machinery or enzymes that can break down some of these dietary components, and they actually provide us as a host with about 10% of our sort of calories or energy.
So that's the energy side of it. What do we know about some of their potential and what we're starting to understand? You used the phrase almost another organ within, you know, the organ there, the stomach and the digestive tract. What else can they do that we're starting to get an inkling of?
Yeah, so there's just been an explosion of research in this area, again, over roughly a decade, a little bit more. And what we know now is that these bacteria are actually have been sort of associated and sometimes even causatively linked with a number of sort of human diseases. And so that goes all the way from cardiovascular disease, from lipid disorders, just to sort of the ways as sort of as hosts that we kind of store fat and how that fat works in our bodies. And then really common things like diabetes. And so we know that our gut bacteria are involved in sort of regulating how our bodies respond to a lot of these processes.
Well, you are part of a research looking at the effects of different types of diet on the functioning of these microbes, and you tested a plant-based diet against a quote-unquote more Western diet, which sounds like it was meat and higher fat and sugar. So tell us about how you researched this.
Yeah, sure. So it's been known, it was known prior to our study that the bugs living in our gut are sensitive to what we feed them, and that's largely because sort of what we eat as a host is almost entirely all that they see for food. And so they really depend on their host diet for the vast majority of sort of their energy. And so it was already known when we were going into this study that if you feed a host, you know, either, and this has been shown in both humans and some work done in mice and rats too, but if you alter their diet, you not only alter sort of who's present in the communities, but you also alter kind of what sorts of chemistry these bugs carry out and sort of what products that they make. And so for our study, we wanted to look at sort of what's an ideal diet, which is sort of this more kind of plant-based normal diet for a mouse. Sort of what does that do to the community and how does that change when we feed the host, you know, a pretty unhealthy diet, one that's high in very simple sugars and high in fats.
So when you said it, we can change the bacteria, the gut bacteria that are present, does that mean that, I mean, this is an obvious question, but that these gut bacteria, you know, live, die, and renew, and then different ones join, that it really is sort of like a colony?
Yeah. So it's a really complex community, and there's, you know, there's trillions of them living in our gut. And it's sort of the best way to think of it, and it's really what's happening, is they all sort of have a niche. And, you know, just like us, if we have certain things that we do or don't need to survive and do or don't need to be happy, it's the same for them. And so if we feed them, you know, certain groups of bacteria really like these plant-based foods, and other bacteria do really well when the host is fasting and there's no food, and others do really well when there's lots of simple sugars and fats. And so it's just, it's not that any groups completely go away. It's just that sort of some populations, we call it bloom. Mm-hmm. So some will expand and we'll see sort of more of what they do.
Okay, so what did you find when you compared the gut bacteria with the Western diet, the less healthy, high sugar, high fat diet versus the plant diet?
Yeah, and so this is where it gets a little complex, but so the big thing that we focused on was so not only how the bacteria changed and how sort of the products that they make as a product of their metabolism and their chemistry changed when we gave them different diets, but we also then took a step farther and kind of looked at the host animal itself, and we looked at something called its epigenome. And so the best way to think of an epigenome is to think about how in the late 90s there was the Human Genome Project, and we sequenced, the scientific community sequenced the entire human genome, which is just all the collection of genes in a human body, to 99% completion. And everyone thought at that point that, you know, once we had the sequence for the human genome, you know, once we had the blueprint, that we would know everything about health and disease, and that turned out not to be the case. So we need more than just the blueprint, and now we know that there are lots of other factors involved in sort of regulating sort of who gets to read the blueprint and what happens when you read the blueprint. blueprint. And so we study some of those proteins, and they're called histones. And they're sort of, the best way to think of them is sort of like a spool, and the DNA is the thread that wraps around the spool. And the spool can be modified in different ways, and how it's modified sort of affects how accessible the blueprint is to all the different machinery. And so what we looked at was how the bacteria, and more importantly, all these different products that they make that then get absorbed by the host and end up in our circulation, how those different products can actually interact with some of the machinery that affects these spools, or sort of affects how accessible our blueprint or our DNA is. And we found that that actually is affected differently on the different diets.
So you're saying it can affect the chemicals that affect the gene expression, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you found it can have a difference. There's an impact here. So what happened with, if these were mice, right?
Yes, tested mice.
What happened with the mice who had the Western diet, the unhealthy diet?
Yeah, so it was totally surprising, and we were really excited to see it. But essentially we saw the way that we designed our study, where we had as a control, we had some animals that essentially grew up in a bubble. And they really do, there's a picture we sent you, and they actually are grown in a bubble, and this bubble is completely sterile on the inside. And those mice are a nice sort of control. So these mice have never seen any bacteria, any viruses, any fungi. They're completely naive to those things, and we kind of compared our mice that were exposed to bacteria back to that group. And when we had mice on a normal kind of healthy mouse diet, we saw a lot of changes in these kind of spool proteins, or the proteins that affect access to the genome. But then when we put our mice on this kind of Western unhealthy high sugar, high fat diet, those effects completely went away.
Completely went away. So
yeah.
That's pretty dramatic.
Yes, it was.
We're talking with Kim Krautkramer right now. We're talking about gut bacteria. Kim studies this at the UW-Madison as part of some new research looking at new information about how diet can affect the microbes living in our digestive system. And overall, what is the goal here in terms of how this research could affect things like genetic expression and health in people?
Yeah. So as a group of basic scientists, I work in John Deneau's lab, and to do this project, we work very closely with Federico Rey, and he's a bacterial physiologist, and we're more of the epigeneticists. And so what we wanted to do is, we saw there's this really wonderful kind of wealth of research linking gut bacteria, gut bugs, to a lot of different human diseases, and a lot of them are metabolic diseases, like diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And it's a lot of really nice correlative data, and we wanted to look at, to sort of understand more, what are the kind of smaller molecular mechanisms that are sort of driving these processes. And so that was our main goal with this work, and I think that's really where the potential is with this work. So now that we know that these things happen, we know that the gut bacteria can affect a lot of these disease processes and also health processes, what are the actual molecular mechanisms? What are the specific factors, kind of subcellular factors that are really driving these processes? And, I think once we understand those, we have a lot of potential sort of for not only guiding, nutritional guidelines, but also, for learning better how to combat some of these disorders.
And it sounds like another thing you found was that it's not just the microbes themselves, you were saying this, but it's the way they metabolize and produce these. I read about short chain fatty acids, and those can have a difference. And it sounds like you can take some of this, the byproduct of the microbes, put it in the sterile mouse without the gut biome, and something happens.
Yeah. So that was actually one of the coolest things. And again, we were really surprised when this actually worked. But we took a group of compounds that we know the bacteria make, and we also know that they make more of these compounds on a good, healthy mouse diet, and far less of these compounds that, as you said, are called short-chain fatty acids. When we put them on this kind of Western-type, high-fat, high-sugar diet. And so we wanted to see, can we sort of mimic colonization, or can we mimic a mouse that has bacteria just by giving a germ-free mouse these compounds? And so we supplemented we put it in their water, and so we supplemented them for a number of weeks, and we looked at whether or not we could see the sort of the same epigenetic effects in the germ-free group that got supplemented, and we were able to sort of recapitulate about 75% of that pattern that we saw.
Wow. So it's so easy through the water, because we've done other interviews on this program talking about trying to harness some of those good gut bacteria and having to do less pleasant things like fecal transplants. So is this possible we could get this through water one day?
So I think we probably have a different palate than mice. And so these, if you were to smell some of these compounds, they don't smell very good. In fact, some of them are when you think of spoiled milk or really stinky cheeses, it's actually because of some compounds, some of these compounds exactly, and also some that are similar. So we probably wouldn't want to drink water supplemented with them. But I think, you know, that's, again, kind of part of why we're really interested in sort of at the molecular level and at specific, you know, at the level of specific compounds and specific factors in cells, precisely for reasons like that, and why this becomes exciting. Because if we can understand which specific compounds are involved, then we might be able to give them as a dietary supplement. It's a long way off, but that's part of our motivation.
That's what I was going to ask. How far off is some of this that we're talking about? It seems like the potential is enormous. But it also, you also have the sense it might not be tomorrow. I don't know. How quickly is the research moving that we might be able to treat some human diseases by looking at our gut biome?
So the research is moving at a frenetic pace. It's really hard to keep up. There are a handful of really new and exciting papers that are coming out in the literature, and really high quality papers every week. So the research is moving very quickly. However, I think, you know, it still could be years before we have some sort of a miracle solution, if ever. And it's mostly just because we're very complex organisms and these communities are very complex. And so I think we're making a lot of progress and we're making it quickly, but there's a lot to be learned.
Kim, thanks so much for telling us about it today.
Thank you.
That was Kim Krautkramer. She's an MD, PhD student at UW-Madison studying gut bacteria and its function in the body. Joining us there to talk about new research, new information about how diet can affect the microbes living in our digestive system.
Allegations of abuse, neglect, and sexual assault have plagued Wisconsin's Lincoln Hills Juvenile Correctional Facility this year. We'll hear from Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel in just a bit on the possibility of reopening a state investigation and possibly filing charges against staff.
But while Lincoln Hills has been in the news a lot this year, our next guest reports that there have been signs of trouble for much longer.
Patrick Marley covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been following this story closely and has laid out a detailed timeline of the issues at Lincoln Hills going back almost 4 years. His article is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's go back to the point in history when other juvenile facilities were merged with Lincoln Hills. Inmates were moved there. Why did that happen?
So the state's inmate population for juveniles was dropping quite a bit year by year, and over less than a decade, half the number of inmates held by the state that were juveniles, it had dropped by half during that time. And so it just didn't make sense to continue to have these two large facilities. So Governor Doyle, before Governor Walker, started studying the issue. A task force concluded they needed to shut one of the two main prisons they had for juveniles. And when Governor Walker took over, they shut down both Ethan Allen, which is in Waukesha County, and Southern Oaks Girls' School, which is in Racine County.
And under the Doyle administration, you write that there was a recommendation that this be done slowly and deliberately. Was that how it was done?
No, it was done quite quickly. In the beginning of 2011, Governor Walker took office and moved to close down Ethan Allen by that summer. So by July, you had everybody who was at Ethan Allen and Southern Oaks brought up to Lincoln Hills, 215 miles from Milwaukee.
We'll get into the impact of that in just a moment, but apparently there's a law that requires us to have a juvenile facility in northern Wisconsin in particular.
That's right. In 1970, Lincoln Hills opened, and before that, they passed a law that said that there needed to be a juvenile delinquent facility in a line that goes between La Crosse and Manitowoc, somewhere north of that. That was put in place by a state senator known as Tiny Krieger. He's from the area, represented the area where Lincoln Hills was, and wanted to make sure that they had a facility up there.
So these inmates, juvenile inmates, students, as they're referred to sometimes, are moved up to Lincoln Hills. Can you talk about the impact of that on the inmates themselves and on the staff at Lincoln Hills?
Well, the vast majority of inmates in that are held by the state are from the Milwaukee, either from Milwaukee or southeastern Wisconsin. And so they're a long way from families. Many of them are lower income. It's difficult for them to get up there. So they are able to see their families less often than when they were at Ethan Allen. For the facility, it was a big change because they had this large influx of inmates, nearly doubled in population, and they had to go on a hiring spree. They got approval to bring in 100 more guards or youth counselors, as they're called there. But the prison is in a pretty remote location, and they struggle with hiring and retaining people. So that means a lot of overtime for staff in a very difficult working environment.
Yeah, you talked to some staff and union people there. Talk about the kind of overtime they were doing and how they felt it affected their lives and their jobs.
Sure. So it's pretty common to have to work a 16-hour shift and to have to do that, many days during a week. And so you talk to guards who talk about having trouble driving home. You know, some of them have an hour-long drive home, and after a shift like that in the middle of winter, might have difficulty staying awake. When you work long hours, your nerves can get a little frayed, and the population you're working with is definitely one that puts you into some intense situations. And so they raise concerns about how, when you're deprived of sleep, you can maybe react in a way that isn't the preferred way.
So you have this overworked staff, it sounds like, many of them new on the job after that hiring spree you mentioned, and then inmates coming in from a new facility, all of a sudden a whole new, in effect, a new element in the equation. Talk about what that part of it was like.
Right. So the one thing that they talked about during that transition period is that, prisons have a pecking order of who's the boss, who's in charge. And so you would have arguments, fights over, who was top dog, so to speak. There's sometimes gang or gang-like groups in prisons, and if you had two of the same branches of a group coming together, there would be disagreements over who was in charge at this new facility. So you had, some tensions among the inmates at that time.
So describe what life was like for the juveniles at this institution starting after the merger. What kind of things were going on before this started to surface?
Well, the problems seem rooted in this transition when you had this big increase in the inmate population there, and what we know now are, some very questionable things going on, including one guard getting in a fight with inmates, some injuries that occurred, suicide attempts, families not being contacted when these kinds of things were happening, law enforcement not being contacted. So it was sort of a snowball effect of bad things happened, and then there were bad responses to them, or there was this, they were overlooked by the staff and the management there.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, getting the long view behind the recent events at the Lincoln Hills juvenile facility in northern Wisconsin. Some people were trying to raise red flags, Patrick, including a judge. Can you talk about what one judge did to try to alert the governor to what was going on there?
Sure. That was the time when the biggest sign of problems would have arrived in the governor's office. This is 8 months after the facility has transitioned to Lincoln Hills. And there's a Racine County youth who was sexually assaulted by his roommate and then beaten and knocked unconscious. He's, the boy says he was unconscious for about an hour, gets up, alerts staff. They don't get him medical treatment for 3 hours or more. And the social services department in Racine County learns about this, and no one from the prison contacts law enforcement about this assault and beating. It's the hospital staff that 6 hours after this happened tells the local law enforcement so that they can go investigate, and they ultimately charge the inmate who did it, and he was convicted. But the Racine County officials are not told by Lincoln Hills about this. They find out only that the victim of this crime was put into a segregation unit the next day for disruptive behavior, and they start asking about it. They're not getting responses. And then they get an anonymous letter from another inmate who knew him. They tell them what happened, and they investigate. And finally, Lincoln Hills comes clean and tells them about this. And when Racine County asks a psychologist up there why did you wait so long to get this kid medical attention? The psychologist tells him that, well, there was a basketball game that day, and basketball is a big deal here, and the quote that he gave was, what did you want us to do, stop the basketball game? So the judge learns of all of this, and then he writes a short letter to the governor along with a 2 or 3 page fuller memo describing what happened, and tells the governor this is sordid, he's never seen anything like this in his 18 years on the bench, and the governor never saw that letter. His aides did not give it to the governor, and they left it for the Department of Corrections to handle. I talked to this judge recently. He said he never heard back from anyone about it, and he was very shocked that it wasn't taken more seriously.
What happened that finally made someone take this more seriously and start investigating?
So then Milwaukee County, a couple years later, in late 2014, starts learning about any number of abuses or allegations of abuses. And the Public Defender's Office learns about that, and they tell the Department of Corrections through the Milwaukee County DA's office. And so the Department of Corrections starts an internal investigation. Within a couple of months, alerts the State Department of Justice that they believe crimes are being committed. And the Department of Justice spends 10 months investigating with two agents who were working on the case part-time. We now know a number of abuses occurred during that time that were not apparently detected by the Department of Justice. And it is only when an inmate declines to go into his room and a staff member shoves him into the room and shuts his door and closes the door on his foot, causing him to ultimately have to have parts of two toes amputated, that all levels of government finally kind of kick into action and addressing it more seriously. And 6 days after that happens, the State Department of Justice descends on the facility with 50 agents and spends weeks up there interviewing staff and inmates.
So fast forward to today. What is the current state of affairs at Lincoln Hills?
So that raid I just described was a year ago. Soon after that, the State Department of Justice turns the investigation over to the FBI. The U.S. attorney recently told me that this investigation is continuing, that it's complex and taking a lot of time, but that they are taking it seriously and they are continuing to look at this.
Amid all this, you also talked to one national expert on juvenile corrections who said this idea of having one facility far away from the urban area is really going against the trend of where people are going in the United States.
Yes, the preferred model, experts will tell you, is to have small local facilities so that you can keep juvenile offenders close to their homes, where they have more family connections and more access to the actual services that they will get once they're out. They like to have very small ratio between the staff and the number of inmates. And that way they can treat it more as a sort of a treatment situation to try to bring down recidivism rates. That, of course, is an expensive effort, though, you know, Lincoln Hills is a very expensive endeavor as well. It costs about $100,000 a year to keep one inmate there.
And that reminds me, this is supposed to be not just a facility, a detention facility, but a school. And that was another concern raised, that many inmates not going to any kind of classes at all at some points, it sounds like.
Right. So in the center, so it's a campus essentially with a large fence and razor wire around it that have these small cottages that can each hold 25 inmates. And then they've got a high school in the middle of this where the kids go every day. Most of the kids go. Some that are in the segregated housing unit don't get to go there. And they have classes. The Department of Corrections say that things are in order now, though they have some trouble retaining teachers, just like they have trouble getting guards there. But there were concerns earlier that kids weren't going to class on a routine basis, that when they would go to class, they were not getting quality instruction, that teachers would just show Hollywood movies, do whatever they could to just keep them in their chairs. And that is actually the issue that first raised the concerns of Milwaukee County that ultimately led to the internal investigation.
And now judges, especially in southeastern Wisconsin, it sounds like are in a quandary. They don't know. There's only one place they can send kids in some cases, and they don't want to send them there.
Right. So it's important to remember that people who go to Lincoln Hills have been, you know, it's not the first place someone is sent unless they've committed a very serious violent crime, or that usually they're sent to group homes, they're sent to other community-based settings, and then they either run away or they have a continued series of problems or they have a string of very violent crimes, and that's what sends them to Lincoln Hills. And so, you know, judges we talk to say that they're, as you put it, they're in a quandary because they need to keep the public safe, and yet they are being asked to send them to a place that itself is suspected of abuse and negligence.
We'll leave it there for now. Patrick, thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rod.
Patrick Marley covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been following the Lincoln Hills story.
Part of the ongoing saga at Lincoln Hills was an investigation run by the Wisconsin Attorney General's office, which started early in 2015 but was turned over to the FBI earlier this year.
Until this week, the Attorney General had taken a hands-off approach since it was no longer a state investigation. Yesterday, according to reports, he gave indications that he would be open to considering a resumption of the state probe. I talked to Attorney General Brad Schimmel this morning. Attorney General Schimmel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're in the news this week of this ongoing scandal at Lincoln Hills. You are open to the idea of maybe of reopening the investigation here in Wisconsin. The FBI is still doing it, and maybe new charges. What's up?
Yeah, the story really isn't what it was made out to be when it came out. I was asked whether it was a possibility that the state could get involved again. We're 9 months into the federal investigation. I don't know what they are or are not doing. So I was asked whether it was possible the state could get back involved, and that is possible because the federal and state systems can both operate at the same time. It's duplicative. We don't want to be tripping over each other. So that is a potential at some point. I'm not under a big time crunch right now because we haven't heard since back in 2015 any youth correctional officers for whom there were allegations of abuse made. They were all removed. So we haven't heard any ongoing allegations of abuse. So as long as that's the case, then I don't feel under a great time pressure to step in. But at some point, we may do that again.
And I know Lincoln Hills is under the Department of Corrections, so it's not your department in a way what happens to it in the future. And you've mentioned that. We've heard from judges, especially in southeastern Wisconsin, who are saying, there's only one place I can send some of these kids who've committed some serious crimes, and I don't know if I can send them there. Is that interfering with juvenile justice in Wisconsin?
Well, I think that depends on which judge you're in front of. For some, this decision is more difficult than others. The bottom line, and I echo something that the Milwaukee District Attorney said, is you don't get sent to Lincoln Hills easily especially from Milwaukee County. The juvenile justice system attempts to take. And they have to, by law, and it's the right thing to do, to use the least restrictive alternatives. You try supervision in their homes. Then you go to residential treatment often. You make other steps before you go to corrections with them. And so by the time they get committed to the juvenile corrections system at the Department of Corrections, they have really earned their way there.
We'll leave it here on that topic for now. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel talking about the Lincoln Hills Juvenile Corrections Facility. We'll hear more from the Attorney General on a variety of issues next week on the show. We also talked earlier to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Patrick Marley about the history behind the scandal at Lincoln Hills. You can find his reporting on the Central Time Facebook page.